Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby-related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Deb Flaschenberg, and I'm your host of Yoga Birth Babies. And in this podcast episode, we talk all about newborn procedures from right after baby's born to the first 6 to 12 weeks of baby's life. So we're going to talk about everything from umbilical cord care, circumcision care, when to bathe your baby, how to bathe your baby, feeding. Oh, that is a huge topic. How much to expect in the first day to few days, and what happens to baby's weight, especially if the parent takes an epidural and they have extra fluid in their body. How does that affect baby? So we take a deep dive. We talk about the eye ointment, the vitamin K shot, really a deep dive into understanding some of baby's weird behaviors from birth until the first 6 to 12 weeks. So to have this conversation, I have Dr. Wendy Hunter. She is a pediatrician in San Diego, California. She rounds on newborns at Scripps Hospital, and her podcast, The Pediatrician Next Door, mixes the science of medicine with the realities of parenting. She incorporates integrative therapies into her practice, and she is so delightful to talk to, so easygoing, and just really opens up to what to expect right after baby's born. Because I think it can be a very overwhelming time. Baby's out. When do we clamp the cord? When do we start feeding? What should we expect? And I just love Dr. Wendy's approach. I think you're going to get so much out of this conversation. Before we get to my conversation with Dr. Wendy, I always love to give updates about what's happening at PYC. So we are heading into the summer, my favorite time of year. We are continuing our classes online 7 days a week. We have our classes in studio 6 days a week. We have our workshops, all of our workshops, everything from caring for a newborn, which pertains very much to this podcast, to breastfeeding, to childbirth education, to comforting touch for labor, so much. And if you can't make it to the studio, we've got everything on demand, so you can check it out on your schedule, on your time. We have also completed all of our prenatal yoga teacher trainings for the school year of 2023-2024. We already have applications and spots filling for our fall, our September-October 2024 prenatal yoga teacher training. We do it online 3 times a year and in person once a year. We just finished our online postnatal teacher training. It was super fun. I was really glad I got to do that with a wonderful group of students. And so things are just plugging away. So if any of this is speaking, singing your tune, check all this out on our website at prenatalyogacenter.com. You can find our workshops, our online classes, our teacher training, our blog. There's just so much, all our past podcast episodes. So check that out. Now, I do have one thing to ask of you. press pause after I finish saying this and please leave a rating and review so people can find the podcast. I love speaking to experts and picking their brains to give you what their expertise is and for you to support yourself and learn. And by leaving a rating and review, it helps other people grow and learn as well. So we can pay it forward and support our community. So thank you for doing that. Okay, enough of me talking. We're going to take a super quick break and when we come back. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Wendy Hunter. Hi, Dr. Wendy. How are you?
Hi, Deb. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited to pick your brain. So for full transparency community, I just got to finish a conversation with Dr. Wendy on her podcast. And so I'm loving this conversation, this relationship we got going. So I can't wait to turn the tables and ask you all the curious questions I have. So thank you for coming on.
My pleasure. I'm excited to talk to your audience because I really enjoy having sort of a holistic approach to child health. And so you kind of walk on two feet. We're going to talk about some of the basics of mainstream medicine, but also it's so important to take care of our bodies in the way that you do.
So before we jump into picking your brain as a pediatrician, I would love to learn a little bit more about you and what inspired you to become a pediatrician.
Back in med school, the first day, the dean came in and said, you're all going to pick a specialty eventually. And those of you who worked at summer camps or babysat, you're going to be pediatricians. And I was like, well, that's just set. So that's how that happened. And how I became sort of passionate and found my sort of brand of medicine is that I started my career out as a pediatrician working in an emergency department. And so I only saw sick kids or parents who were the most worried. So especially with babies, my real passion has been that parents need to understand why their babies do the weird things that they do. Babies are very physiologically different from any other human. And so they do all these weird things that parents totally freak out about because if your husband suddenly threw his arms up and was shaking, you would be extremely worried, right? But when a baby does it, it's completely fine. So that's where my passion lies and is sort of explaining to parents what's different about a baby and why we have to treat them a little bit differently.
Oh, I love that. But why do babies throw their arms up and start shaking?
Yeah. So when you're born, your nervous system doesn't have any insulation on the wires of your nerves that control your entire body. That's called myelin. And it develops over time. So you have all these weird reflexes because your nerves don't transmit signals the same way as an adult. So the same thing happens, if a person has a stroke, they lose some of their adult neurologic function. And so some of the reflexes you see in a baby come back in a person if they have neurologic damage.
Oh my goodness. I had no idea. That's actually very fascinating. Wow.
Well, you're welcome. When you play with babies in your yoga studio, I'm sure that you see some of these things come out. They move differently.
Oh yeah. They get weird facial looks. Yeah. Something now that you say a stroke victim. Mm-hmm. Yes. Some of their facial, their face gets all kind of funky and their arm, you're right. Not that I've seen a lot of stroke victims, but what's portrayed in movies, but yeah, they do get these weird movements and almost also weird breathing patterns sometimes too.
Oh yeah, we should talk about that. There is a breathing pattern called periodic breathing that yes, if you started panting and then paused your breathing, I would think there was something very wrong with Deb. Uh-huh. But babies do that. They pant and blow off a bunch of carbon dioxide and then their brain thinks they don't need to breathe anymore. So they stop breathing and then they start breathing again. But yeah, an adult can't do that.
Try to do that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Babies are fascinating. All right. So I wanted to start to talk a little bit about, because as a pediatrician, I'm sure you're involved with the postpartum and newborns a lot. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the very formulaic process that parents endure after their baby's born, and then how families can be a little bit more in control of that process. So right after baby's born, how can they be more in control of that?
I've got a ton of tips, but it is interesting that you say formulaic because yes, it is formulaic and it's on purpose because in general, everything that we do for a baby, it's literally a checklist that happens in the hospital. And all of it is based on a whole population of people. So if you look at 100,000 babies, a few of them are going to have an eye infection as a result of birth. And so as a result, we just put eye ointment in every baby's eyes, you know, antibiotic ointment to prevent that. So everything that happens in the hospital is done on a checklist, and your baby is part of that process.
Yeah, so, I remember as a doula seeing that. Like, baby would come out, and there was literally, like, every time I'm like, okay, they're checking for this, they do this. It's literally, so it's good to know that it actually is a checklist. It doesn't just appear that way.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you don't want to miss anything either. Your question is, where are some of the points that you can make some decisions?
Yes.
And you need to understand why we're doing each of those things. So it's fine to ask, because you can't make a decision if you don't know why. So probably the most important thing is, as soon as the baby is born, there's two questions. One about clamping the cord and the other about skin to skin. And everybody, I think, already knows, like, you should put your baby skin to skin as soon as possible. We call it the golden hour. And you should hold your baby for at least an hour right after they are born, even if they don't nurse. Some babies have a reflex. They will climb up your body and latch and try and breastfeed, which is incredible. So that's the first decision, is you should insist on them giving you the baby immediately. They do not need to go and wipe the baby. So if there's an emergency, obviously, you know, let the doctors take your baby and resuscitate the baby. But then the cord clamping too, the new trend, which is scientifically based, is to delay your cord clamping for a few minutes. And the doctors or the nurses, the doulas, they can all make that decision with you together.
But how much do you have to push for that? Because I feel like I've seen some doctors would be like, 30 seconds. Some will give like a few minutes. Some will go much longer. What do you see as kind of like the I don't know, right amount of time, or a kind of golden amount of time? And how does one push for that?
I know that's tough, because every hospital is different and every physician is different. So you have an OB walk in the room, they're going to just clamp because they got to go somewhere else. They'll cut the cord. And then say you have a doula there, they're going to recognize, okay, this is a thoughtful family. We've got, you know, you want to be part of the process. Maybe they'll delay a little bit longer. The right amount of time, I don't know. It probably is a few minutes. It doesn't need to be longer than that, but you're waiting for the blood from the placenta, which is the baby's blood in the placenta, to go back into the baby. So the baby really just needs to take a few breaths. And once they do that and they're breathing pretty comfortably, the pulmonary vasculature, so the blood vessels around the lungs, have now filled up with blood, and it's allowed the blood to transfer back from the placenta. So that can happen, you know, 10 breaths probably.
Fantastic. All right. So you started to talk a little bit about the eye ointment. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Why babies have it? How much do they need? Is there any getting around that? I know for my births, I did 2 home births, and even with the home birth midwife, she's like, still got to do it.
Antibiotic eye ointment was initially started to be used because we were trying to prevent the baby from getting a gonorrhea eye infection. And where I live in the state of California, it is a law to apply the ointment. Because gonorrhea used to be the number one cause of childhood blindness. So now that actually is a much less common cause. But we are still seeing infections from other bacteria, either from mom's skin or from her intestines. So we're putting just one dose of antibiotic eye ointment on the eyes so that babies don't have infections from the birth process. And it doesn't have to be done immediately. It can be done a few hours so that that can allow for skin-to-skin time. It can be done a few hours after birth. But really, if you think about it, I mean, a lot of people do ask not to have the eye ointment. And they'll say like, oh, I know I don't have a disease. But the truth is, you are talking about a topical antibiotic ointment for one dose. Like, that is not going to do anything harmful to your baby and cause any problems. So I would just do it.
Yeah, I was always taught to look at the risk versus the benefit. Mm-hmm. So I think by looking at that, it might help someone realize, okay, the risk is pretty great if there is a chance there is something that could be passed, and the benefit is great to be like, okay, just a little bit of eye ointment could make a huge difference.
It can make a huge difference. And then the risk of the eye ointment is like nil. There's like no risk.
Like there's no, like there's so, maybe I didn't say it right, but the risk of infection is great. You know, if you don't do that, you know, if you should have that.
It's dire circumstances. I mean, you do not need a blind baby.
No. And that actually made me think of another situation that sometimes comes up is if somebody's GBS positive, groupie strep positive, and I know there's ideally the parent should have two rounds of antibiotics 4 hours apart. Mm-hmm. But what if you have a precipitous birth and you get one or none? What's the risk to the baby, and what would one do if the baby didn't get that?
That's another one of those things that's just on a pathway or an algorithm at the hospital, is that if mom is GBS positive or group B strep positive and didn't get what we call adequate antibiotic prevention during labor, then we typically will just watch the baby for signs of infection. And oftentimes they will do a blood draw on the baby a certain number of hours after birth to look at their white blood cell count and just to see if it is too high. And then they might worry about the baby.
So it's more of a watch and see.
Exactly.
Yeah. Got it. Since we're talking, we've got the GBS, we've got the eye ointment. Let's also talk about the vitamin K shot. Can you explain that too?
This is another one that I just don't understand why people avoid it. There's really no harm to giving the vitamin K. So basically, babies are born with a little bit of a vitamin K deficiency, and vitamin K is needed to clot your blood. So we think that there is probably a benefit to the baby having a low vitamin K level so that they don't clot off their umbilical cord when they're born. Oh. But you can't walk around with a low vitamin K level later. So before we gave vitamin K shots in the hospital, 1 out of 100 babies had bleeding either from their belly button or from their mouth, or sometimes in their brain. And so we
That's a lot.
Hemorrhagic disease of the newborn or vitamin K deficiency bleeding just terrifies pediatricians, because you can bleed into the brain. And it was a pretty high percentage of kids who did. So it was really alarming. And so the shot, you put it into the muscle of the leg, and it is purely vitamin K. There is like nothing else in it. And it slowly releases over weeks after the birth of the baby. So there isn't an oral form. And even the oral form, if you did give vitamin K, it's not absorbed in that same way. So this is a nice slow rate. It's basically like what the baby would get if they like stayed in for another 3 months. You know, if you stay pregnant for 3 more months, you could fully form this baby and give them all your iron and vitamin K. So anyway, I don't see a real harm to giving the vitamin K, and significant harm if you don't.
All right. So we're going to keep going on some of these basic newborn procedures. And this isn't directly after. I want to get back to like bathing and all that. But since I'm kind of on the trail of talking about medicine, what about vaccinations in the hospital? Are babies getting vaccinations right then and there? Or are they seeing you like a pediatrician days, weeks after? What's that look like?
Probably the most important vaccinations that are done are given to the mom when she's pregnant, because then she gives her immunity to the baby. So we can talk more about that. And then surrounding yourself with other humans who are vaccinated. So, you know, don't let anyone around your baby who has not been vaccinated for whooping cough. So that's the pertussis or P that's in the Tdap vaccine. So for the baby, it is pretty routine to give the first hepatitis B vaccine while the baby's in the hospital. And we do that because it works very well when you give it to someone young. And hepatitis B is devastating. In 90% of kids who get hepatitis B have liver complications and can go into liver failure. And I've seen those kids. It's not very easily transmitted, though. So if mom has hepatitis B and you know mom has hepatitis B, you need to give the vaccine. But what about you don't think that your baby's going to have a high exposure to hepatitis B? There are people walking around who may be holding your baby who may have chronic hepatitis B, and you wouldn't necessarily know. And you really do have to have very intimate contact to contract hepatitis B from another person. You really need to get like saliva or blood. And so it's unlikely, but it does happen. The other really weird scenario I've seen, and I'm sorry to go on so long.
No, I find this fascinating.
So this is the weirdest scenario, but we had a baby who was at daycare and accidentally got another mother's breast milk.
Oh, yeah. I'm not surprised. I could see that happen. Yeah.
So then we had to check that the mom didn't have hepatitis B, and then check that the baby was vaccinated. That got very complicated. So your baby can be exposed to hepatitis B. It's pretty unlikely, but that is a vaccine that we know works really well when it's given young. We do give it at 2 months, 4 months, and 6 months, the booster. So you don't necessarily have to give it in the hospital. You can get it a little bit later, but I can get on my high horse here. I don't like to talk a lot about immunizations because I know it can be really controversial. In some states, you have to have hepatitis B vaccine to go to school. And parents who delay giving the vaccine, they end up giving their 3, 4, or 5-year-old the hepatitis B vaccines right before school. And those kids are mad. So
is it a very painful one? Or
I mean, they don't want a shot. And so it's kind of nice to get them done and out of the way when we know that the vaccine works better the younger you give it.
We did all our vaccinations, but we did space them out a little bit. And there was one that somehow got left off. And my son was in the twos program at our preschool in Montessori preschool. And they looked at the forms. They were like, he needs this immediately. And I'm like, okay, I think it was polio, if I remember correctly. I'm like, I promise you, I'm not trying to take that off the table. So luckily our pediatrician, she's like, come right in, we'll take care of it, we'll sign your forms. But I just remember they took it very seriously at our preschool.
Yeah, they do. So, and how did your child react when he had to get the vaccine at that age?
The funny thing is he had no problem. Like if he would get shots or even blood taken, he would watch. He thought it was kind of fascinating. Now that they've had all their COVID shots, they don't like them as much because they feel like they're getting them a lot. But overall, my son handles it much better than my daughter. Yeah, she would be the one that's mad and pushing against it.
Right. So it's a tough call when to give them. But other than that, there aren't any other vaccines you need to give in the hospital after.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. All right, cool. I want to talk a little bit more about other procedures in hospital, things that maybe people want to delay. But we're going to take a super quick break. When we come back, let's talk about when baby gets its first bath. We'll be right back.
Our family has grown. Welcome to the world, Hannah baby. Introducing a new collection, Hannah Soft, made with Tencel. It's so breathable, with stretchy comfort for all of baby's first moments. And it's cool and gentle on their skin all year round. Entrusted Hannah quality for your most precious gift. Hannah Soft, made to last. Shop now at hannahanderson.com.
We are back. So I know this can be, I don't know if controversial is the right word, but I've had students have big conversations about that. When should baby get its bath?
So we used to bathe the baby like immediately, but now we do recommend holding off on the bath. So, babies have that white cheesy stuff all over their body when they're first born, and that is the vernix. And it is a great way for your baby to transition to our environment is to leave that vernix on. So you don't want to wash that off. And it's also full of anti-infective properties, and it has like natural fats in it that help the skin not get too dry. So we love leaving that vernix on for maybe a week even.
Oh, I love that. Rubbing it in, really letting their skin get nice. And I love
that. If the hair is really matted, I usually say just give them a little shampoo of the hair just because it can get pretty gnarly.
What about umbilical cord care?
Yeah. So when my kids were born, we cleaned the umbilical cord constantly with alcohol, and we've realized that that caused the umbilical cord to stay on too long. So there's been a big change now. And then we say, now, let the cord dry naturally. We've learned that disinfectants aren't needed to keep it clean. There's natural bacteria that keep your body's bacteria in check, really. So you want to let it dry up and fall off on its own. And it is okay to take a bath when your child's umbilical cord is still on. That is fine. I know a lot of people try to wait until the cord falls off, but just tell grandma, no, it's fine. And the other thing about umbilical cord care is a lot of people will put a coin and tape it over the umbilical stump to prevent
coin? Heard this one.
Yeah, they want to prevent an outie. So it's not going to prevent an outie, and it can cause irritation and infection. So don't put anything on top of the cord either. But yeah, you can just let it dry and fall off.
All right. This is where my brain goes. So I never actually thought of this before until you just said that. What causes the innie or the outie?
We think it's genetic for the most part. Yeah, it's not really the doctor's fault.
Were people blaming the doctors? Is that something that...
Oh, yeah. Or they'd say like, oh, I had a really expensive OB and he gave me a star-shaped umbilical stump. No, they can't actually do that. I mean, some people do have a little hernia. It's really common to have a small hernia in the umbilical area, and that can sometimes leave you with an outie.
Okay, yeah, I never actually thought of what might cause it. I guess as you were saying, and I'm like, I wonder, is it the way they're tying the, like, clamping? And yeah, okay. So it's just, it is what it is. It's one of those things that we just get. Okay.
Exactly.
It is what it is. Mm-hmm. What about circumcision care?
Oh, you know, people always worry about that. It's funny because I don't do circumcisions myself, but I do refer out. And people always ask, what am I going to, you know, how do I care for it later? You would be shocked at how quickly they heal, honestly. Like, I feel like you put the diaper on and you blink and all of a sudden you look and there's like, you can't even tell they had a circumcision except the skin's gone. So basically they just put some Vaseline on the tip of the penis after the circumcision and just leave it for a day or two. And it just heals. I don't know how. Babies have great blood supply.
They do. And they're nice and fresh. All right. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about feeding, because I think there's a misconception about how much to expect a baby's going to eat right after it comes out. Like, so can we talk about kind of that whole gamut of like the size of their bellies, how it starts small? Like, yeah. What can someone expect in terms of feeding?
That is a great question and so complex. So yeah, first of all, if you just picture your baby, look at the size of them, and then picture how small their stomach is, it is like the size of a walnut. So you can't expect a newborn to eat 2 or 3 ounces. They will spit it up because there's no space. So in those first couple of days, moms should start making some colostrum. That's that really thick golden substance. And you're not going to get much. If you pump and try and measure, you'll get like 2 to 5 milliliters. We're talking about like a teaspoon to a tablespoon, maybe. And that stuff is just nutrient dense and will serve your baby well for even a couple of days. Babies are born with a ton of extra fluid on their bodies. So they are not going to get dehydrated, you know, in the first 48 hours, even if they don't really drink much at all. So the goal in those first couple of days is put the baby to the breast often to bring your milk in. We expect babies to go down in their weight up to 10%, and that's normal right after birth. They're born with all kinds of extra energy and water so that they can just sleep for a day or two. And a lot of them will be real pokey at first and not want to latch, not want to breastfeed. And you just have to give it some time. So that's just the tip of the iceberg on that. Do you have other specific questions?
I do. And I want to keep, if that's just the tip of the iceberg, I want to give you the space to go deeper into that iceberg. But I do have a few other questions. Mm-hmm. I guess one of the questions that comes to mind is, when someone chooses to have an epidural, they're going to need at least 2 bags of fluid so that their blood pressure doesn't drop. And then they're going to have continuous fluid. And I remember doing a podcast with a lactation consultant, and she was saying all that fluid gets absorbed into the parent's tissue as well as baby. And so keeping that in mind, when we talk about that 10% drop, baby could be born with a bit of a inflated birth weight, depending on how long the parent was on the epidural and how much extra fluid. Is that taken in consideration? Is that something pediatricians think about asking about how the birth happened?
No, I think a lot of pediatricians miss that. So this is a crucial thing for parents to know, is that you need to be aware of this issue. But the point is, yes, I often, if a parent has had a lot of fluids during labor, I will often consider the birth weight, the weight that was taken on the second day of the baby's life. That's probably more true. They're going to pee all that extra out. They're going to be born edematous, you know, edema of their body with too much fluid. They'll pee it out on the first day. But yeah, I think a lot of pediatricians start to panic when yes. they see the baby at 4 days of age, 5 days of age, and the baby's down 12 or 15% from their birth weight, they panic and they make you start supplementing with formula. And the truth is that baby's not down as much from their true birth weight as it seems. And so, yeah, look at mom. If mom's feet are swollen, then you know that that's the issue, that the baby was also swollen and that birth weight was overinflated.
I hear this from my students a lot that they're like, oh, okay, my pediatrician had me start supplements. And I don't know if this is true, but then they're saying then baby was getting nipple confusion and their supply wasn't coming in because baby was also taking a bottle. And there was a lot of frustration and many just give up. Plus their breasts are different because all that fluid is changing their nipple, which gets flatter
because
of that.
Yeah, we've got to stop over-medicalizing this and just give moms the space to let their breast milk come in and let the baby figure it out. The best way you can tell is if the baby seems relatively satisfied most of the time, they're getting plenty. They don't need anything. So I wouldn't supplement a baby unless they're just searching and crying frantically. And I'll tell you the way that I would supplement, and I don't think that formula is an F word. I'm okay with formula. I want all moms to breastfeed. But in that interim, if you really don't have any milk and you just need a day and the baby's frantic, I like to use something called a supplemental nursing system. It is a long, skinny tube and you attach it to a small syringe. You put literally 5 or 10 milliliters of either expressed breast milk or formula in the syringe. And then you stick this tiny, tiny tube on your nipple into the baby's mouth while they're at the breast. And oftentimes they'll have a good enough latch and suck that they will pull the extra milk from the syringe. So I'm talking about a cord that's probably like, I don't know, 18 inches long. So it goes on the mom's nipple, goes over her shoulder, and then another caretaker can hold the syringe and push in the milk. And the baby thinks that they're getting it from the breast and they're on the breast. Great. So that's my favorite way to supplement. Although I think most babies actually don't need supplementation.
Let's keep going. So you said what you were saying was just the tip of the iceberg. I kind of want to just open it up and offer you, let's go deeper into that iceberg. What am I not asking? What do you want to go into?
Everything's going to change in the first, you know, 2 weeks or a month. So every day is going to look different. And I know parents, you know, we have this really high standard. Like we think we're supposed to do everything perfect or by the book. And you really just, you need that time to get to know your baby, right? They're all going to have different rhythms. And it can be really hard and frustrating when you think your baby wants to feed like every hour and you don't feel like you have enough milk. You know, why is the baby feeding so often? Are they satisfied? Plus, it's complicated by the fact that you can't see how much milk is going into the baby. So you don't know. There's just, I mean, there's so much anxiety about all of this. And I really want to just get back to that point where you look at your baby and if they are satisfied, like they fall off the breast and fall asleep, they're getting something. Also, if they pee, you know they drank something. You know, as long as they're peeing, if they make a wet diaper every 3 hours, you should just be satisfied and keep going, reassured.
I like this. I think one of the things that tends to happen is the anxiety. Is my baby getting enough? Especially for a new parent. It's so new and so overwhelming. And everyone wants to do the best they can and they just don't know. So I like that you're kind of turning back the anxiety and just looking at your baby and trusting. So that's really helpful.
There's one other sign you can look for too. So if parents are like, oh my God, my baby's starving. If they're just laying there, if you stroke their cheek a couple times with your finger, if they're hungry, they will turn towards your finger and open their mouth. If they're not hungry, they will just ignore you. So that's a good way to tell too if your baby's satisfied.
Oh, I have not heard of that one. That's kind of fun to know. Let's talk a little bit about sleeping because that's always a question. It is, I know you're like, we just opened up.
Do you have another hour?
Yeah. I guess the question is, what should we expect in terms of a baby's sleep pattern? Because it's going to change. But let's just say the first, I don't know, 2 to 6 weeks.
Oh my gosh. It can literally be anywhere around the clock. You have no idea. Babies don't make melatonin, so they aren't going to have a cycle related to sunlight or anything like that until they're probably 3 months old. So you have to adjust your expectations to that. A lot of babies slept when you were moving around when you were pregnant. They were lulled by that. So if you're moving them around, they're going to fall asleep. If you don't move, when you're pregnant, they tend to be more awake. So when you sleep, when you're pregnant, you're not moving. Baby is really active. So once they're born, they're going to have that same kind of pattern. They may still stick with that, you know, being awake when you're asleep. But also, if you go and move them around, if you put them in a baby carrier and you walk around with them all day, they're going to sleep. So you can try to keep them stimulated during the day, you know, lay them down or just hold them and talk to them and look at them, try and keep them awake, but they're going to sleep when they want to. And they're probably, the most common pattern is a baby is going to eat for 20 minutes or so, and then they're going to be awake for like literally minutes, and then they're going to sleep for 30 minutes or so. And they're going to do that cycle over and over again. So you're talking about a 1 hour cycle, basically. Could be as long as 3 hours on that cycle, but they're going to sleep most of the time.
I remember my mom telling me when my brother was born, he was a colicky baby, that to get him to sleep, she would drive with him. And we lived in outside of Boston at the time. She's like, I drove all around Massachusetts. And then when she couldn't, she put him on the dryer, those little seats, those little chairs, and put him on the dryer. I thought that was hilarious.
Right. So it's really important to understand like the developmental stage that your child's at, because you can't drive around your two-year-old to put them to sleep. That's a terrible idea, and you're going to teach them bad habits. But you're like 2-month-old, it's fine. It's fine.
I mean, eventually he figured out how to sleep. Mm-hmm. So, okay, what else, kind of pulling us back to babies in the hospital, what else should parents be considering in that whole birth flow? Because I feel like we talk so much about the birth process and a birth plan, but we don't talk about a postpartum plan. So I want to make sure we're covering all our bases of like in hospital birth, postpartum plan, and then the first few weeks out of hospital and those, you know, first 6-12 weeks of just trying to figure out life with baby.
I guess the two most important things are, number one, don't rush home. You know, a lot of people want to get home and, you know, stay for a day or two if you can, because you've got the support in the hospital. The other thing is family, you know, dealing with family coming around. They all want to see the baby, and you just need to decide on your boundaries, especially if it's your first baby. You want to be home with your partner and really bond with the baby and be allowed to walk around with your shirt off and, you know, be the mess that you are. So talk with your partner about your boundaries and how many visitors you want at a time and who can come and how long they can stay. And it is fine to tell people they need to go home. It's fine to tell them they can't come. This is about you and creating your new family together. So that's the other thing I would say is really important about those first couple of weeks.
That kind of brought another thought to my head. So what about, you mentioned not letting anyone near a baby if they haven't had the whooping cough vaccination, but what about, because the baby doesn't have much immune system, if I'm correct, and please correct me if I'm wrong about that, but should people always wash their hands before they come in? If they have a cold, I'm guessing they don't stay. What are your thoughts on the health of visitors and how close they get to baby?
Yeah, I think the most dangerous person to be around your baby is a toddler. They are gross.
Well, they're petri dishes.
Yeah, exactly. They're petri dishes. So it's those friends that have a 3-year-old at home who goes to daycare that I might kind of avoid. But it's so great because in this, you know, post-pandemic era, nobody minds putting on a mask. You know, so you can ask visitors to put a mask on when they have their face in the baby's face. I think that's a good idea. And yes, you should always wash your hands before you pick up a baby. Those are easy, you know?
Yeah. When my daughter was born, my kids are 2 years, 7 months apart. My son was sick and we lived in a 2-bedroom apartment on the Upper West Side. And when we would go from...
Of course he was sick. Of course he was sick.
Biggest fear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when we would go from room, we might've been overkill. We would like change our clothes from one room to the other.
Because right.
We're like, brand new baby, like days old. And my son was sick. So we like, I wouldn't wear the same shirt in his room and the baby was in our room. Like we were crazy people. So might've taken it too far, but the germs just felt huge.
I don't know. Pediatricians are like that in the first 28 days of their baby's life. We cocoon them like you wouldn't believe, because we know if your baby gets a fever in the first 28 days, they have to get a full workup with like a blood test and a urine test and even a spinal tap.
Oh,
so
geez.
You should be crazy in the first 28 days.
After that,
it's not so big, such a big deal. You know, and don't cocoon your, you know, 2-year-old. Like,
no, you can't.
You gotta let them get sick.
Yeah, so. Like a dog, you gotta run them around.
Yeah, so. I think your craziness was on the end of being appropriate. I think that's appropriate.
Oh, I feel better now. Good. All mm-hmm. right, so now that we've gone through immediate postpartum, immediate baby being born, when should somebody have this conversation with their team? Because it might be, they're probably going to talk to their doctor about their birth plan, but when do we talk postpartum plans or the nurses? How do we get everyone on the same page?
Oh my gosh, it's so funny because we all used to recommend having a written birth plan. And like literally, I think most of the time it just goes right out the window. So you can't have too high of expectations of what's going to happen because inevitably you're going to end up with a C-section and it's all going to be irrelevant. So it's really tough. But yes, educating yourself on all the things we talked about. So knowing what's going to happen, and we talked about, I think, everything that happens in the birth hospital and why it happens helps you to be able to make real-time decisions. You always do have a pediatrician, and that's a second voice. So every baby is seen in the hospital by a pediatrician, and you can ask them to help guide you with these things too.
Yeah, so someone doesn't want to have their baby bathed, or they do want to have delayed cord clamping. I feel like mm-hmm. most hospitals, unless there's some huge reason, they're going to do skin to skin. But just making sure that some of these. Oh, another thing that's kind of new is like a gender reveal, like baby's born and who says, you know, boy, girl, or otherwise. So,
like, do we want to know? When do we want to know? Yeah. It's so hard too because, you know, the nurses change shifts. So you could have a nurse at the beginning, you tell her everything you want, and then your next nurse comes in and they have no idea that you wanted specific things. I've definitely had patients who did not want a vitamin K shot and the baby was given one just because it's routine and it happens and, you know, it's just kind of chaos. So I don't know if I have any really good advice about how to communicate. It's tough. You just have to advocate for yourself, try and be aware, have someone there with you. Always a good idea to have either a partner or a doula or a friend who knows your wishes and can keep an eye out for things too.
No, that's a great answer. All right, we're going to take one more break. When we come back, what is one final tip or piece of advice you would like to offer new and expectant parents? We will be right back. Okay, we are back. So I'm actually really curious because you are a mom and you're a pediatrician. So you've been so in the trenches. And so I'm curious, what has bubbled to the top of your brain? One final tip or piece of advice you'd like to offer new and expectant parents?
Yeah, my head is swimming. I think we touched on anxiety, and that is something we all really need to respect. And recognize, I think, you know, nobody talks about postpartum anxiety. We talk a lot about postpartum depression, but just the act of having a baby that you are now responsible for the rest of your life, it is anxiety provoking. So just know you have people out there to help you. It's okay to be anxious. It's okay to be scared. Write down every question that you have because inevitably you'll go to your pediatrician and we are there to hold your hand the whole way. We want your questions, but inevitably you walk in our office and we'll say, do you have any questions? And you're like, I have 100 and I don't remember one of them. So write them down, use your resources, give yourself time to heal, allow yourself to feel anxious and recognize it and know that it's okay and that it's normal. Also recognize if you think it's out of proportion to how anxious you should be because there is help for that. And it's really an under-recognized condition. Trust your instincts and know that you are able to advocate for your baby and everyone wants to help you.
That actually gives me a follow-up question, if you don't mind me digging a little deeper about the anxiety. Mm-hmm. How much or do you, as a pediatrician, do any sort of observation of the mental health of a new parent when they're with you? And because new babies are seeing the pediatrician pretty often in the beginning. Mm-hmm. How much, the Edinburgh, is that correct?
Yeah, we use that. Yeah, so there's an Edinburgh depression scale. And I don't know how many pediatricians' offices are using it, but we do. We screen every mom by giving them a questionnaire at a couple of the different newborn visits to look for depression in the mom because we know that it affects the way that babies are raised and the health of the baby. You know, maternal health is really important and there's so much we can do to help a mom who's having anxiety or depression. So yeah, generally it tends to show up around 6 weeks of age is when I really seem to catch it. And that's when I talk to moms about it.
I think it's great that you do that because I think sometimes the immediate family may not understand or have the background to be like, this is a little beyond the norm of anxiety or depression. And having an outside expert eye being able to observe, I think is so, so valuable. So I love that you do that.
Yeah. And the questionnaire is great because it does help you sort out, like, is this normal amount of sadness or is this, does this need help?
Yeah. Where can people find your work?
Oh my gosh, I'm all over the place. I love to share on my podcast, The Pediatrician Next Door, and I'm on Instagram as well at the same name. And I do accept questions. I sometimes answer them. I often answer them, or they inform what I present on my podcast. And my clinic is in La Jolla, California.
Nice and warm. Every winter here on the East Coast, I'm like, why do I live here?
Yeah.
Oh, Dr. Wendy, it was so fun talking to you. Thank you for just your open, honest, and candid answer. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for all the work you do, and thank you for letting me share.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.